Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us today. I recently spoke with Craig Clunas about his new book, Screen of Kings, Royal Art and Power in Ming China. This was produced by Reaction Books and the University of Hawaii Press in 2013. This was a real treat and a real special pleasure for me for many reasons. First of all, the book is beautifully written and absolutely beautifully produced. It's a really gorgeous object as well as being extraordinarily stimulating and just enjoyable as a narrative. But also the kind of work that Craig is doing in this book is very explicitly and deliberately revisionist in a way that's really productive, really engaging, and really, really, I think, important and also good to think with. So what he's doing in this book, among other things, is he's shifting our attention away from some oft-trod territory in Ming history. So the kinds of areas, the sorts of historical figures, the kinds of practices and ways of thinking about space that tend to dominate our narratives, and toward a set of figures, Ming kings, a way of thinking about space as sort of polycentric here, and a way of prioritizing regionality, and also thinking about who was responsible for the production, dissemination, and reproduction of material artifacts and documents in a way that's just very new and very refreshing. So it's interesting both because it's just an inherently interesting and engaging story about the production of art, artifacts, documents, and different manifestations thereof, but it's also really a model, I think, of what it can look like to try to tell a history of and with figures who don't leave the same sorts of obvious documentary and physical traces as some of the figures who otherwise populate our histories. So it's a really wonderful book. I think it's absolutely a must-read for anybody interested in the history of art in China, the history of the Ming, or relationships between kind of systems of power and geographies of power and the production of the arts. It's also just, like I said, a really beautiful book and a really beautifully written book. So I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed talking with Craig about it. And I hope you have a chance to take a look at the book. And also, I hope you enjoy our conversation. We're here today to talk with Craig Clunas about his new book, Screen of Kings, Royal Art and Power in Ming China. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Craig, and thank you so much for navigating the time difference between our two localities and for making the time to talk with me today. I'm really, really excited about the book. I think it's important and fascinating and also quite beautiful. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So could you start us off, as is traditional for the channel, by saying just a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, what brought you to the history of the arts in China?
Well, my original training wasn't as an art historian and wasn't very specifically directed towards the arts. I did a fairly traditional Chinese studies degree at Cambridge as an undergraduate, which was, you know, your old school European sinology degree, which was very, very textually based. It did include an option, or it did include at one point some material on archaeology, which I found, I have to confess now, pretty tedious and pretty hard going. And the things that interested me more were the literature of China, particularly the literature of the late imperial period, the Ming and Qing. And I kind of specialized in Ming and Qing fiction. That was what I did as an undergraduate. And then I went on to write a doctoral dissertation in Qing literature, in 19th century Qing literature, on the relationship between a body of fiction written in Mongolian and literature written in Chinese. But then my career kind of, I'd always been interested in the visual arts, and I had in fact spent some time volunteering, interning, I guess you would say, in a museum, in the National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh. And so when a job was advertised at the Victoria and Albert Museum in 1979, I applied for this job. I didn't necessarily think I would get it. I certainly didn't think I was a shoo-in for it. And I had this spiel at the interview about how the fact that I'd kind of read the Honglo Hmong meant that I knew a lot about Qing material culture. This was essentially a bluff. but it wasn't completely a bluff. I mean, I sort of believe it was a bluff, but I kind of believed it myself at the time. A man called John Ayers, who was head of the East Asian department at the V&A at the time, was generous enough or imaginative enough or whatever to give me the opportunity. And so I worked for about 15 years in the V&A as a curator of Chinese art. And the kind of things that the V&A has are not the sort of calligraphy and painting that are at the heart of the canon of Chinese art. They're the so-called decorative arts of the late imperial period, the Ming and Qing, and that's how I became more of a specialist, worked on those sort of things, and then stepped sideways into teaching art history, first at the University of Sussex and then at SOAS, and then since 2007 here at Oxford in the art history department.
Great, thank you. So the book that we're talking about today explores the significance of members of the imperial clan, what some scholars previously have called princes, what you're calling kings here in the book in Ming China. And it also explores many aspects of the connections and intersections between Ming kings and the arts and makes some really interesting and important revisionist points that pertain much more broadly to how we understand and practice and read Ming history on a global scale. And so we'll get to those more specific elements over the course of our conversation. Can you say a little bit, though, first, to get us oriented, about how you came to this particular topic? Where does this fit within your larger research trajectory? And how did you come to a decision to create a book-length object around this particular topic and theme?
Well, you used the word revisionist. And I suppose I think to myself that this is in a sense revisionist of stuff that I've written myself, in the sense that ever since the early 90s, I've been working pretty concentratedly. It's not the only thing I do, but most the big projects that I've done have all been in the Ming period, but they have all tended to concentrate on the so-called literati elite of Jiangnan. I mean, a number of the projects that I've done, from a book called Superfluous Things in 1991 onwards, have dealt with the family of the famous Ming literati painter Wen Zhengming, who dates from 1470 to 1559. And I've even written a monograph called Elegant Debts, which is just about Wen Zhengming. So this is about the landscape of Jiangnan, of the region of the lower Yangtze Delta, the kind of the urban center of the urban heartland of Ming China, and what we very much thought of as the kind of cultural heartland of Ming China. But kind of about, well, I think 8 or 9 years ago, various things other people had read, things I'd read myself in primary sources, began to make me think, isn't our history of the Ming very Jiangnano-centric, in the sense that our understanding of the period is very much driven by the artifacts and the accounts that mattered to a particular kind of elite in these big cities of the Lower Yangtze Delta. So I'm talking about Nanjing and Suzhou and Hangzhou and cities like that. But you know, if we teach our students anything about China, the first thing we always want to teach them is that it's very, very big. And so it's partly me thinking, hang on a minute, what's happening outside Jiangnan? What's happening in Shanxi or in Sichuan or in Shandong or, you know, the rest of this vast empire? And the minute that you start to look outside Jiangnan, where there weren't any members of the hereditary imperial aristocracy, so there weren't any of these guys, these kings or princes or whatever you want to call them, and I presume we'll get onto that terminology in a minute, but whatever you want to call them, there weren't any of them in Suzhou or Hangzhou or Nanjing or around those parts. But as soon as you got to a major city elsewhere in China. And these are, you know, these are major historical centers like Xi'an in Shaanxi province or Chengdu in Sichuan. These are the big figures, the prominent figures on the cultural landscape. So there's that kind of thinking. And then there's also the kind of happenstance that archaeology in China itself has started to produce very spectacular finds related to this these body of people, partly because they tended to be buried on the outskirts of major cities. And so, you know, you're building a shopping mall or you're building a parking lot on the outskirts of Chengdu, you know, the kind of archaeology that you might well come into contact with might well be Ming aristocratic archaeology. And so there's a big body of new excavations. And some of this has been very well published in China. And I guess that's part of it. But I think then there's also the serendipitous stuff that, you know, you get asked to do things and you think, oh, this might be a good idea. And so I got asked to contribute to a volume edited by Wu Hong at Chicago, which was about kind of Chinese engagements with the past or the uses of antiquity. And that led to a sort of chapter length bit, a bit about calligraphy, working on calligraphy and rubbings and so on. That's one of the chapters in the book. And then I thought, no, there's more here. This is what I want to work up into a book-sized project, which is what I've tended to do. I've not been a great writer of journal articles, you know, highly as I value that format, but I've tended to do a smaller number of bigger things rather than the article length thing. I've tended to enjoy working at the book length project.
Mm-hmm. Actually, since you just mentioned that, because that's particularly fascinating to me from the perspective of craft, can you say actually a little bit more about that preference? What for you is compelling about the practice and the craft of working on a book-length project versus a smaller, more contained journal article-length object?
Well, there's the kind of the unworthy desire to see your name on a spine. You know, you know, I see my name on a spine, therefore I exist, you know, so that it's a way of staving off existential crisis. So there's that. I mean, I suppose there's also the thing that if you find you can do it, you know, it's about finding out what works for you, what you're good at. And I've found that I can do this. I mean, I think there's a real issue now about whether books are the sensible thing to do, because in the new digital environment, you know, a journal article that is available electronically is going to reach a much, much wider audience than the scholarly monograph. And, you know, the scholarly monograph, there are people out there who are prepared to read the last rites over its grave. But I suppose I began my career, you know, at a point where the book was the kind of gold standard. There's also a thing that, I mean, I never turned my PhD thesis is sitting quietly gathering dust on the shelves of SOAS Library, because my career took this 90-degree turn from the work on kind of Qing literature and Mongolian literature into working on the decorative arts. I never published my thesis. There's no book of the thesis. So I don't know, you know, at some psychological level, maybe I'm trying to make up for that, that non-achievement. I just don't know. I mean, I suppose I've done it several times, and so I've gotten used to the rhythm of the big project. And you know, you would have to say that what feels like the big payoff, but I'm not convinced it's the best way to get work out there. You know, I think as people get busier, you know, Do we have the time to read books? I know that there are, you know, I'm sitting in this office here surrounded by other people's new books that I wish I had the time to read, but, you know, I may not read them, whereas I might have time to read a journal article. So, you know, they're a mixed blessing, I think. Mm-hmm. I think another thing I would say is that I've been very fortunate to work with a very special publisher. And that's Reaction Books in London, who didn't publish my very first book, but they published my second book, which I'd published a load of books with the Victoria and Albert Museum, but they were books about the museum's collection, and in a sense, the museum had to publish them. And then I did the first book. I did Superfluous Things in 1991 with a publisher called Polity in Cambridge. And then my second book, which was Fruitful Sights, which was about gardens, got turned down by a load of publishers. I won't name them, but a load of publishers turned it down. Reaction Books said, no, we'll do this. At least one very distinguished publisher turned it down on the grounds that this falls between two stools, which is a kind of interesting, it shows you that, you know, interdisciplinarity is a great idea, but if publishers don't know which part of their catalogue to put your book in, they may turn it down. Okay. Whereas Reaction Books, you know, took up Fruitful Sights, I found working with the people there, you know, working with the people who do the production, I feel it's a publisher where, you know, they care about what they're publishing. And so there's always been from them a kind of, you know, what are you working on? You know, can we see the new thing? You know, we'd really like to. So that feeling that there's somebody who wants to see the next book manuscript is maybe one of the things that makes the production of a next book manuscript slightly easier.
Great. Thank you. So this book that we're talking about today focuses on or centers on the role of what we've alternately been referring to as princes, as kings, for the purpose of our conversation. And you've brought up the already in your introduction of the book and of this theme, the tricky nature of this term. And in some ways, one of the really important kinds of work that the book does is to make us think again about this term that often many of us who work on Ming history tend to take for granted as, you know, princes. And in rethinking this term and in rethinking the kind of work it does, really replace who these people are on the landscape, not just geographically, but also conceptually, epistemically, and historically, of the way we understand the Ming and the Ming in the world. So with that in mind, first things first, what is a Ming king for our purposes today? And what do listeners need to understand about that category of people in order to understand the kinds of arguments that the later chapters of the book are going to make?
Well, maybe I could start by saying that I don't think I'm going to be able to make the term king stick. and I'm not really bothered about that, actually. I would be perfectly happy if people carried on using the term prince, if, as you've just suggested, they kind of rethought what their role was. That seems to me to be the more important point than that I should get my way about the translation. And so the translation is slightly, you know, it's slightly provocative. It is designed to make people say, you know, whoa, you're that's not right. You're not supposed to say that, are you? So the Chinese word is wang, you know, a very simple word, you know, still one of the most common Chinese surnames, obviously, and a term which goes right back into the earliest sorts of Chinese texts we've got, right back into the Bronze Age. And really the kind of eureka moment for me, and I've mentioned this in the book, was that if you're reading Mencius, now Mencius was the, you know, the first classical Chinese text I, you know, was set to read as an undergraduate. That was what we worked through. And the actual chapter that we worked on was Liang Hui Wang, you know, which you translate as King Hui of Liang. You know, Mencius meets King Hui of Liang, the king says, you know, blah, blah, blah. So this word Wang is always translated as king. And the Chinese archaeologists dug up early in this century the tomb of a man whose title is Liang Zhuangwang, right? It's the same character Liang, you know, which was one of the princely one of the states of Bronze Age China, that of the Warring States period. So it's the same Liang and it's the same Wang. It's a slightly different title, but immediately we translate this as prince, you know, because you know, we just can't say king, can we? So I thought, well, why can't we? Why can't we say king? Let's just think about who these people were. In order to be a Qin Wang, the imperial aristocracy in the Ming period came in various grades. At the top grade are the grade called Qin Wang, and that would be usually translated or traditionally translated as princes of the blood. A Qin Wang is the son of an emperor, other than the crown prince. So typically in the Ming period, the kind of the succession rules say that the eldest son will be crown prince and will be emperor after his father, and all the other ones will be called Wang, will be Qin Wang, and they will, at a certain age, when they become kind of formally adults, so that's around the age of 14, they will go to their states. So the Chinese is Zhiguo, you know, they will go to their Guo, you know, Guojia de Guo, or, you know, Yinguo, Meiguo de Guo. This word that, you know, in modern Chinese means state or nation. And of course, in the Bronze Age terminology, you know, gets translated as, you know, the warring states, you know, Jian Guo. So Ming China is conceptually covered by these Guo, these states that these princes, kings, you know, as I say, I'm not going to die in the last ditch for the term king. You know, so these aristocrats, they go to them. You have a system whereby the oldest son of the king becomes he inherits the Wang title, and then all the others are Jun Wang, which is commandery king, I'm translating it as. And then, you know, their eldest sons inherit that title, and their next sons get, all the other sons get another title, defender general of the state. And these titles go down through titles, you know, right down to supporter commandant of the state, you know, Fenguo Zhongwei. These are, so there's loads and loads of, there's a very, you know, it's a very kind of complex Baroque aristocratic system. And there's a parallel set of titles as well. So, you know, the role of kind of aristocratic women in the Ming landscape seems to me to be really important. And a basic fact just struck me. One of the things that the literature on these people had always said is, you know, there's a lot of them, you know, because the you know, they multiply. You know, if every son of a king is, you know, a Jun Wang, and the, you know, so these titles multiply. Also, you know, as you go through the Ming, there are new princedoms or fiefdoms or kingdoms or whatever you want to call them, created. Some Ming emperors didn't have very many sons. Some had very large numbers. Obviously, the Ming founder, Zhu Yuanzhang, the Hongwu emperor, he had a huge number. So many of them descend from these sons of the Ming founder. So you've got this kind of growing number of them. And it just struck me that, you know, in the Ming, whether in the early Ming or in the late Ming, if you were in a city like Xi'an or Taiyuan or Chengdu, you were much more likely to see a member of the imperial aristocracy go by in the street than you were to see the holder of a jinshi, you know, the top level of the imperial civil service exams. You are much more likely to see a prince than you were to see a district magistrate. You know, the number of district magistrates in the Ming was very, very much smaller than the number of aristocrats. And yet, if you think of our kind of the sort of accepted history of the Ming. Think of something like the two Cambridge History of China Ming volumes, which are, you know, wonderful creations of collective scholarship. The amount of space given to the aristocracy is kind of tiny. You know, they're kind of noted that they're at the beginning. They're in at the beginning of the story, and Hongwu did this with his sons, and then they kind of fade out of the story in the Yongle reign, and they're never really mentioned again. But it just struck me that if we wanted to think about local society, and this would come back to kind of, you know, something that's been, you know, gnawing at me for years and years and years and years and years, which is the kind of the role, or I mean, I don't know if you feel this in your own work, but sometimes it dawns on me, or I have this thought: what if we've got it wrong? Mm-hmm. And I don't mean what if we've got it a bit wrong? What if we've got it all wrong? You know, what if we've got it wrong in a kind of big, major way, a way where we kind of, you know, we tell ourselves the same story over and over again. And in some ways, the story that we've been telling ourselves about the Ming Dynasty over and over again since the Ming Dynasty is the story that, you know, Matteo Ricci was the first to tell Europeans, you know, this is different. It's not about, you know, in this country, the wise govern, you know, this is a place where, you know, the ruling class are a kind of intellectual elite selected rather than kind of hereditarily there by birth. And he had a very particular agenda, I think, behind this story. If you think about kind of who the Jesuits were and what their agenda was and the kind of story they're trying to tell. And then this gets overlaid by other agendas, the kind of 17th century agenda for explaining the fall of the Ming, you know, why did this dynasty collapse? Then the whole kind of May 4th agenda for explaining China's feudalism, and one of the kind of, you know, points I've tried to make in the book, and this, you know, this is me, you know, nobody, you never make anything up from scratch. I think you read other people's work and you think, hang on a minute, I could make a contribution, or what I know can chime with this. So, you know, I'd read many years before, but then I'm remembering the work that Prasenjit Dwara did on the whole notion of Feng Jian. How does Feng Jian come to mean feudal? Which, of course, as we know in the history of 20th century China, is completely a bad thing. And that would be true whether in kind of liberal May 4th movement historiography or in Marxist historiography after 1949, and equally in Japanese Marxist historiography of the 20th century. So Feng Jian is a bad thing because it's feudal, you know, that's backward. This is all part of the big issue about, you know, explaining China's development or lack of development. So there's a kind of perfect storm of contempt and disregard, mm-hmm. which is about saying these people are bad and they don't matter, mm-hmm. You know, that they're completely terrible and we don't have to pay any attention to them. And even just in that, it seems to me there's a kind of, there's a kind of paradox. If these people really don't matter, how can they have such a terrible effect? And if they have such a terrible effect, then surely they matter. And that's leaving aside the question of whether they do have a terrible effect or not. And I guess some of it's coming out of, you know, reading the history of other parts of the world. I read quite a lot of early modern European history. I try to keep up with work being done on other parts of the world. I think it's really, really important for a historian of China to not just read Chinese history. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's very easy to fall into a kind of exceptionalism. Just as I think it's really, really important for historians of European history to read some Chinese history. And, you know, I will take any opportunity that I can to kind of, you know, try and make them do so. And I think the stuff I've written, I also try and write in a way that reduces their excuses for not reading it.
That's right.
You know,
I think that's a really good way of putting it.
I mean, you can't make people read stuff, but you can write in a way that reduces their excuses for not reading it. And this is a book which is very consciously written in a way that I hope that, you know, historians of other parts of the world might read it, that they wouldn't be able to say, oh, this is very technical, or you have to know a huge amount about you know, Chinese culture in order to get a handle on it. I am trying, and I would acknowledge that at certain points there's probably a certain sleight of hand which kind of hides some of the complexities, but it hides them in the service of reducing the excuses of historians of other parts of the world for saying, oh, we don't possibly have to know about that. That's something happening way over there. It's got nothing to do with us.
Well, this actually, I think, really nicely brings us into some of the later chapters of the book. So just to, there's so much happening in so many of these chapters that we can't possibly hope to get to each one of them, or even each one of the interesting things about the chapters we do get to. So what I want to do is take this as an opportunity to lead us into some of the case studies, but first to mention along the way, as you take us from the first chapter into the later chapters where you're presenting us with the case studies, you elaborate on many of the themes that you've been talking about. And so you talk about Wang, the kings, as fence and screen. And so this speaks to the title of the book, among other things. And talk about, as well, the simultaneous visibility and invisibility of these Ming kings. And there's an entire chapter 2, that lays out the textual and archaeological and geographic landscape of these Ming kings in a way that's extraordinarily attentive to some of the phenomena you've just been speaking to, and that is the nature of the evidence that we have, the way we read the evidence, the access we have to evidence in creating narratives and stories about the past, and the ways that, at the same time, those particularities of the surviving evidence shape what we can say, but also how we can be more attentive to looking for evidence in places we may not otherwise look for, in order to, as well, make sure that we're incorporating kinds of evidence in thoughtful and creative ways that maybe in the past, or you know, maybe right now, some of us aren't as attentive to, and that might shape quite dramatically the way we understand and have told stories of Ming kings and of Ming history more generally. So after laying out this groundwork, and we'll get to some examples that also help bring out some of the larger themes that you talk about in chapter 2, I think later on in the case study chapters, you bring us into chapter 3, and this is the first of a series of case studies that use a particular kind of work in a particular space of work in order to flesh out and develop some of these larger ideas. Chapter 3 looks at the centrality of kings in the creation, the reproduction, and the dissemination of calligraphy. And those terms are quite thoughtfully used, and I'm going to ask you about some of them because I think there's a lot of potential for the kind of work that you're doing in this chapter to speak much more broadly, particularly because of your invocation of some of these terms like reproduction. But we'll get to that. Now, the chapter draws our attention to what you call a double exclusion, both the importance of kings in Ming history, which we've spoken to a little bit, and also at the same time, the importance of calligraphy as an art-making practice. Now, to get specific about this, you, as a way of drawing out some of these ideas, you bring us into a collection or a text that is called, and I'm going to mispronounce this, so forgive me and correct me, Offerings from the Appanages?
Well, who knows? I mean, appanages is not an everyday word in my kitchen either.
Okay.
You know, let's go with appanages. You know, I mean...
Okay. Let's go with appanages. Thank you. So can you introduce just a little bit about this text as a way of opening up what you see to be the importance of the relationship between kings and the practices surrounding and infusing calligraphy in this period? What's important about this text that helps us understand what's important about this relationship as you see it in this period?
Yeah. Well, this must have been one of the kind of key early ideas I was working with, because, you know, I thought you would ask me, you know, when did you, you know, how did you start working on this? So I was kind of looking back through various notebooks. And I realized, you know, in 2007, I wrote in a notebook something about, you know, look into the homology between kings as cultural replicators and projects of cultural reproduction. And so that was very central. And in fact, the chapter on calligraphy was the first bit that I wrote. That was the kind of first thing that I worked on. Again, you know, there are elements of the, well, just the, you know, the context. This collection, this Bosien Tangji Gu Fatie, which is this collection of rubbings, has been very well reproduced and very well published in China. You know, the deeply scholarly work on kind of editions and how it's put together and a facsimile of the thing that gives you the freedom to sort of sit in your desk in London or Oxford and kind of, you know, really, really get to grips with it. Now, it obviously that relates back to kind of chapter two. And I just wanted to say about chapter two that, you know, I could have written that stuff on calligraphy without ever leaving Britain, but the stuff on the kingly landscape is absolutely dependent on, you know, a big research trip to China in 2009, and then to the kind of willingness of colleagues in China to take me places and show me stuff, and not only show me, you know, stuff that I'd asked to see, but say, actually, the thing you don't know about that you do actually want to see, particularly in Hubei. I was very fortunate to meet a real kind of, you know, a colleague in Hubei who kind of got it, what I was interested in, and who said, well, I think if we just go and look at this place, that might, you know, penny might drop for you. So this issue of kind of reproduction, you know, in a sense, kings reproduce the imperial charisma in the provinces. I mean, obviously, they are offspring, they are sons, they reproduce biologically. And this idea about the kind of analogy, homology, I don't really know how I want to put it, between kind of biological reproduction and cultural reproduction, because this is a collection of rubbings. So this is about reproducing the most prestigious form of culture through rubbing, which is, you know, again, something that hardly studied at all until very recently. Wu Hong's written about it. I've had a graduate student work on it relatively recently. But, you know, this fascinating kind of pre-printing, it goes back a long way, this idea that you could cut calligraphy in stone and then you could take rubbings from it, and that's the way that you could hand down, you know, the most prestigious cultural product. So something like, you know, the calligraphy of Wang Xizhi, you know, how high does that stand in the canon of Chinese culture? It's the most prestigious visual cultural manifestation by some distance, by a long way. And yet we don't have any original calligraphy by Wang Xizhi. We have rubbings of carvings of calligraphy by Wang Xizhi. And then it's rubbings which are, you know, rubbings which are copies. I mean, Bob Harris's written this wonderful piece called Copies All the Way Down, you know, which is like turtles all the way down. You know, that all we've got are copies of copies of copies of copies, but yet these things maintain the kind of the charisma. And this seemed to me to be kind of interesting, you know, in thinking about how a copy of a copy of a copy of a piece of calligraphy retains its charisma, and the way in which a kind of a reproduction of a reproduction of a reproduction of a reproduction of an emperor retains some of that kind of colossal charisma. I think maybe an element that I underplayed in the book that I have been thinking about since is the whole kind of, you know, sacral kingship part of it. Again, you know, Ricci and so on led us to think of the Ming and Qing as being very, you know, essentially it's a kind of secular humanist culture. And just as, you know, the recent work on Confucianism has been about putting the kind of the numinous and the sacred back into what we call Confucianism, I think there's something to be said for putting the kind of the sacral and the numinous back into sovereignty, certainly in the Ming period, and the ways in which the regional aristocracy made bodied that forth, kind of were the actual embodiment in the literal sense of that. That seems to me to be, to be an idea worth digging deeper into.
Now, one of the things that you talk about in this chapter, and that continues to be a theme throughout, is the very poor fit, as you put it, between textual and material evidence for the history of calligraphy. And we're going to see this coming up in later chapters as well, especially in terms of what it tells us about the involvement of kings. Now, you tell us almost nothing survives of kingly calligraphic output in the Ming, and when it does survive, it's from individuals who are invisible in the textual record. Now, this theme of invisibility, the importance of invisibility, is key, at least to the perspective of one reader, right? My idiosyncratic perspective. But invisibility is key here. And one of the loci of invisibility throughout the book, but especially in this chapter, is the invisibility of women. So could you speak a little bit to that? Because that's something that's important here, not just in the chapter on calligraphy, but you talk about this in the chapter on painting. You talk about this when you're talking about the tombs and the jewels of the King of Liang. So where are women in your story relative to where they are typically in this story?
Well, a very influential moment for me. I read this very fine book by Ruby Lal on women in Mughal India. So this is India in the 15th, 16th century. So, exactly contemporary with the Ming. And she uses the phrase, she obviously didn't make up the phrase because it's kind of just part of everyday speech, but this notion of hidden in plain sight. That her argument is that Mughal imperial women are very visible in the chronicles, but we've just chosen not to see that. And that was very kind of influential for me in thinking about princes as a whole, because, for example, the Ming Shi is full of biographies of princes. You open a text on Ming painting like the Ming Hualu, and it opens with a section on princes as painters. So, it's not like I've had to dig into, read texts that, there's only one copy somewhere in a rare university library in Japan. This is the Ming Shi we're talking about here. These are the most kind of visible monuments of Ming historiography. But there is a particular problem, I think, about Ming women, which the record is very, very poor, but the fact that so there's a very smooth surface of invisibility. There's a screen, if you like, over them, but every so often there's a kind of punctum. There's a sort of a point of, where the screen, there's a little tiny kind of rip in the screen and a gleam of light comes out, which suggests that there's a whole lot going on back there. So, for example, a relatively recent graduate student of mine, Luck Yu Ping, who now works at the British Museum. So Yu Ping's thesis was about the, you may well be familiar with it. It's a kind of an amazing scroll in the San Diego Museum of Art called the Ordination Scroll of Empress Zhang. Empress Zhang was the wife of the Hongzhi Emperor. So we're talking about the 1490s. And here's this huge scroll, enormously elaborate painted artifact, which shows her being kind of ordained with various Taoist arcana. She's being given the power to summon various deities. This is obviously a big event. There is no textual record of this happening at all. Right? Yu Ping looked everywhere. It's not in the Ming Shi Lu. It's not in the kind of sources that are about the celestial masters. It's not in Taoist sources. So, if this scroll had not survived, and it's a unique kind of thing, we wouldn't know anything about this at all. This incident would be completely lost to us. And therefore, I think occasional bits of evidence like that, well, you could read it two ways. You know, women did nothing, said nothing, had no agency, and that's why there's no evidence for them. You could say that. Or you could say women did a lot, said a lot, were important, but their agency is largely invisible, but the existence of things like this, or like the tomb of the King of Liang, and I've got a reading of that, which I admit is very speculative, but gives a lot of agency to his widow. Mm-hmm. The fact that we've got a small number of dots, and I guess what I'm doing here is just saying, well, let's just speculatively join up these dots, and then we might be able to have, we'll never have a full picture, you know, there isn't some great body of sources that we're not looking in. First year history of art undergraduates, he all read a very famous essay by the art historian Linda Nochlin, maybe you know it, called Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists? Mm-hmm. Right? And what they very quickly learn is that the correct answer to this, or the answer not Linda Nochlin wanted you to give, is not, well, there have been some okay women artists. That's not the right answer. The answer is the category of great artists has been constructed in such a way that women cannot be in that category, mm-hmm. right? So in a sense, it's the wrong question, or it's a loaded question. So, you know, so the question, why have there been no, powerful Ming imperial and royal women, is a question rather like that the historical record we have, and this is true of the kings themselves in the sense that we know, you know, we have, I mean, we, this is the same as true of peasants. You know, we're in kind of Gayatri Spivak territory here, aren't we? Can the subaltern speak? And the answer is no, because if she could, she wouldn't be the subaltern. You know, the definition of the subaltern is that which cannot speak. Now, the interesting thing is that, you know, the Ming aristocracy are subaltern, both male and female, in a certain way, in that they, you know, the historical record is controlled by, the dice are loaded, the record is rigged. It, just as we, you know, everybody would accept that if you were working on medieval Europe, the kind of text you have reflect the agenda of the church, you know, religious professionals, because they were the only literate people. You know, we don't have medieval European chronicles which were written by aristocrats. They were written by members of the church because they were the literate segment of society. So in China, we've got a historical record which represents an agenda. And that's when I come back to the kind of, you know, what if we've got the whole thing wrong? You know, how do we kind of correct for that? So it is a particular problem in relation to women, but I would say that we need to look for those chinks of light in the screen. And the other thing I would say is that if we all assume that, you know, there might be more evidence than we think, so that if we all assume that there's nothing to, you know, move along, there's nothing to see here, and nobody goes and looks, then of course you're not going to find anything. And if we look in some places, I suspect that I think any historian of the Ming would accept that the quantity of the written record from the Ming, which has been really investigated to tell us what it says, is only a very small portion. You know, the same texts have been read again and again and again, and that there is a very, very large body of texts, not just BG, but particularly in things like Wenji and, you know, in people's collected works.
And I think this is actually a really important point, because among the other kinds of work that, at least to me, it seems the book is doing that are really important, is you're giving us here a kind of methodology for historical looking, right? You're showing us how to look, or at least some of the opportunities and the possibilities for looking in places and in ways that otherwise Ming historians may not have thought to look before. And in doing so, you have mentioned the term agency at least a couple of times, and it's another really important kind of work that the book does. So we've talked a little bit about your, I think, quite successful efforts here in this book to let us see the agency of women, but also the agency of kings in terms of the calligraphic arts, the painterly arts for an entire chapter. And also, you talk about agency quite compellingly in the chapter on tombs, the jewels of the King of Liang, chapter 5, where you're using a point about the wide degree of variation in underground tombs as evidence or as possible evidence for a history of agency and choice among these kings. So, in other words, if there is so much variation, then that could be a point of evidence that's letting us see a kind of agency if we know to look, right? If we know how to look and if we open our eyes up to look in that way. Now, another kind of work that's being done here, and this is, we're only getting to, you know, a few of the really fascinating points in all of these chapters, but I want to at least try to get to something in chapter 4. You're using in chapter 4 the case study of painting in kingly households to also make some much larger points that are germane to not just the work that you're doing here in the book, but I think germane to historians of China and also historians more broadly. One of these points looks at the relationship between kings and other elite communities. And one of the arguments you're making here that I think is quite important, especially for Ming history, but again, even beyond, you're showing us in a visual form, by looking at these paintings, how the kings were actually socially integrated with other elite forms around the art of painting. And so this is a way for us to understand the ways that forms of sociality, kingly sociality and other elite sociality, are actually bound up together. So can you talk maybe a little bit about that? Because the importance of kings in the larger social network of Ming China is also a point that comes up quite early in the book as one of the central arguments that the book is making. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think painting is probably the area where the gap between what the written record tells us and what the surviving artifacts are is at its worst. The disparity is at its greatest because, you know, Ming texts on painting, as I say, hidden in plain sight, you know, there's plenty of evidence in very well-known texts, which any historian of Chinese painting of the Ming knows very well, which says, you know, this king was good at painting this and this king was renowned for painting that and so on. And then there's almost nothing, like literally almost nothing. There is one painting that is known about by one of these top rank kings, one dated painting. And that's it, just the one. Now, I should say that our knowledge of what is in Chinese collections is bad. And Chinese collections do not, you know, there are big volumes you can buy called, you know, the collected, you know, things that are in the Palace Museum, Beijing, and so on. But this is not what, you know, these are all selections. And so, you know, like just the other day, I get an email from China saying we're doing a journal on this and we're going to publish three new paintings by Ming members of the aristocracy, which nobody's ever seen before. And I'm going like, what? You know? So there's more, but it's three new paintings. It's not 300 new paintings. So I think my point about the disparity between the textual record there holds. Now, I mean, a long-standing interest of mine, and this, I guess, goes back to my kind of, you know, we've all got roads not traveled, and, you know, I've always been fascinated. You know, I've always read anthropology. I've always been fascinated by the work that anthropologists do. You know, I've always in some measure regretted I wasn't an anthropologist or whatever. And so this whole work on gifts and gift exchange and so on, which was very important, you know, that was the sort of central paradigm of the book I did about Wen Zhengming, was thinking about what does the anthropological work on gift giving and gift exchange bring to our understanding of a case where you do have a very large body of material, as well as a large written textual record. That's in the case of Wen Zhengming. So gifts and gift exchange seem to me to be an important way of thinking about it. These kings did not operate in a vacuum. And it's the issue of their relationship with other kinds of elite. In Suzhou, we have this picture of the Ming and, the literati and the elegant gathering and so on. You know, in Suzhou, they're hanging out with one another. But in Taiyuan or in Xi'an, the kind of the prominent figure on the social landscape is the aristocracy. Every official, no matter how high, if you go past the palace of one of these kings, you have to get out of your sedan chair and walk, or get off your horse and walk, and then get on again. You're not allowed to ride or be carried past the front gate of one of these aristocratic palaces. So every beggar in the street has a perception about who's more important than who. Now, so on one level, Xi'an is a very good case study. There's lots of really good Chinese history on this, and I'm drawing in this book a lot on a new wave of scholarship, of regionally focused scholarship within China itself. But the interaction between these elites, between kind of degree holding elites and the aristocracy, that seems to me to be really productive. And in fact, a student here at Oxford, Jérôme Kerlouégon, who's published himself very extensively on one of the kind of really crucial cultural practices of the Ming aristocracy, and that's their role as publishers. And one of the reasons I didn't write more about books and publishing and so on in the book is that kind of Jerome's sort of done that. He's taken care of that. He's published really wonderful work on that. But what he's thinking about now is this kind of, how did power really work at the local level? What do we mean by power? And by looking at points where kind of power, where it all went wrong, where there's criminal activity or activity which conflict. Conflict often generates a textual record, doesn't it? When everything's going smoothly, nobody writes about it. Things go turn nasty, immediately there is text. And so it's when there is struggle or conflict between the aristocracy, the princes, the kings, and the county magistrates or prefects or grand commanders or the grand coordinators, the high reaches of the provincial bureaucracy. And what you find when you get that is that these guys had their supporters, they had their posse. The texts would often give us the impression that, everybody hates these people, they're oppressive and so on. But for example, if you become a tenant of one of these guys, you can maybe get off paying your taxes. You don't have to pay the land tax anymore. You're on their land and they can protect you from the imperial state. So this chimed very much with stuff that I'm familiar with about kind of lordship in other sort of disorderly parts of the early modern world. I'm a Scot. I read a lot of Scottish history. If you think of Scotland in the 16th century, people were very keen to ally themselves to a powerful lord whose role it was to protect them from the central government, from a weak central government. And people liked being your lord's power was a resource that protected you, A, from the power of other lords, and B, from the kind of depredations of the state, of the central government. So this seems to me, this is taking me, I'm beyond my pay grade here. I'm out of my comfort zone, because I'm not a social or an economic historian, I'm an art historian, and I'm much more comfortable, with a chapter that's got pictures in it. But I do think that there is work to be done, and I think Jérôme Kerlouégon's work will tell us something about what it was like at the local level, where these figures exercised well, you know, you want, you might, you know, I've used the word agency a lot, but sometimes it's just about power. It's about brute force. You know, they had people on their side, and therefore, you know, they could look out for their own people. You know, we're almost in Sopranos territory here. You know, you're being protected from other people's depredations by the power, the authority of the person to whom you have given your allegiance.
You know, when you make a Sopranos reference to a Northern New Jersey Italian American, that you're in good territory. So
okay.
I appreciate that. So this is, we don't have time to talk about all of the fascinating things in all of the chapters. And so I'll just mention for listeners that there is the account of publishing that you alluded to. For listeners who are particularly interested in those sets of issues, they can find a discussion of the importance of Ming Kings to publishing and appanages as centers of sort of reproduction and transmission in terms of publishing in Chapter 6, which is also a chapter that gives a really wonderful account of bronzes and poetry and music and the kind of mutual co-production among the kingly elite and other forms of elite of these cultural forms. But the last kind of substantive question that I want to ask you before we come to our wrap-up and conclusion actually stems from something you've just been talking about, and that's the importance of notions and forms of locality in the local. Because one of the, at least what it seems to me to be a really important point, one of the very important points that you're making in the final chapter, Chapter 7, Remembered Lanterns, is you take us into more kind of modern and contemporary engagements with kingly lineages and kings in contemporary memory. So you bring us into, for example, the Ningxia Palace brand of vinegar, which leads us to a history of kingly lineages. And also you bring us into Hubei province, into a sort of context where you're eating chicken meatloaf or one can eat chicken meatloaf and look at tableau of kingly life. And this ultimately resolves into, at least for me, a discussion of the importance of the king as a local figure. And not just perhaps in the, you know, the kind of simple way we might think about that, a king is associated with a guo, like with a state, with a locality. But really, it seems to me the kind of work that's being done here is about using this appreciation of the power, the agency, the spaces of Ming kings to really reconfigure how we think about locality and the importance of locality as it operates in the context of the Ming, and perhaps as it helps the Ming operate in the context of historiography more generally. So could you speak a little bit to that, kind of specifically this issue of locality in the local, as you imagine it to be imbricated with the arguments you're making about Ming kingship?
I think I definitely would not have worked, that chapter certainly wouldn't exist, and these themes wouldn't have been as prominent in the book if I had not made the research trip to China in 2009. And I should make it clear that, you know, strategically I had decided to go to two places in China. You know, it wasn't going to be possible to, I didn't have the time, I didn't have the resources to kind of go everywhere in China. So I thought, okay, I'll go to two places. And that's why I chose to go to Shaanxi and Taiyuan principally, and think about the kings of Jin and sites around there. And then I'll go to Hubei, partly because of the archaeology in Hubei, you know, the king of Liang in Hubei. And it was really only kind of in modern China that this theme of locality came into being. You know, things like, so, you know, Jin is, as we know, the kind of archaic name for Shaanxi province, but it's also what's on the number plates, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, so if you think about car number plates today, You know, they have on them these Bronze Age state names. You know, the same is true in every province. You know, the name of the province, these archaic Bronze Age names of the provinces are still very much alive and well on things like number plates. And it was having the experience of people saying to me, you know, have this chicken meatloaf. This was the judging emperor's favorite local dish when he was a prince before he moved to Beijing. And I think, well, you know, how can you possibly, you know, are they just like pulling, you know, is this just pulling Lao Wai's leg? You know, we're just kind of, but that sort of sense of the regional, and it was also something that was very powerfully coming to me out of the modern scholarship. So, for example, there is a great wave of, you know, now that we have digital access to all of these, you know, Chinese scholarly periodicals, if you want to read stuff about the kings of Qin, you know, in Xi'an, then, you know, you need to look in the, you know, in the Shanxi Shifan Daxue Xue Bao. You know, that journal, that local journal will have scholarship on, you know, the local region. So in a sense, it was the contemporary situation. And in particular, the sense of them as being, you know, when you see these waxworks of the Jiajing Emperor, as, you know, as we all know, you know, the Jiajing Emperor is thought of as not one of China's kind of most wonderful human beings. But, you know, if you go to his home, you know, he's a hometown boy made good. And there is this kind of celebration of him in that city in Hubei province. So this is what really made this kind of exposure to the contemporary local, the contemporary regional. And if, you know, I mean, it's kind of banal, but if you fly from Shanxi to Hubei, you're eating very differently immediately. You know, your food is very different. And I don't want, you know, stop me if you think, just shout me down if you think I'm doing one of these silly kind of, you know, well, this is the key to Chinese civilization. You know, it isn't that. That's not what I'm saying. But I do think that this idea of kind of, you know, what are the acceptable ways of expressing regional identities in a unitary state, you know? You know, China is very, very large, and there are certain ways of expressing local particularity which central governments don't wish to tolerate, whether that was in the Ming or today. But then there are other ways of expressing local particularity that are acceptable, you know, that are acceptable. And thinking about the boundaries between kind of unacceptable ways of expressing local particularity and acceptable ways of expressing local particularity, that was something that just kind of, you know, was very, you know, it's not just me, this is not, you know, it'd be presented to anybody who travels in China. And is also a way of, I think, getting past the kind of homogeneity of the textual record. Because, you know, a gazetteer from Hubei, a Ming gazetteer from Hubei and a Ming gazetteer from Shanxi don't speak local particularity, except obviously in their content, but in their rhetorics and their kind of their presentation, they look, you know, they're identical. A gazetteer is a gazetteer is a gazetteer, really. And that's true also, you know, if you look at maps, Ming map, I'm talking about Ming maps, I'm not talking about modern maps. If you look at a Ming map of, you know, say a province like Shanxi, then every Xian is the same, looks the same size. Whereas in fact, you know, we're very well aware that then as now, some Xian are very prosperous and some are very poor, some are very mountainous and some are very kind of fertile. But that kind of homogeneity of the textual record, I think, you know, the challenge for us as historians, and this, you know, here I'm drawing on stuff that kind of Dennis Twitchett said to me when I was an undergraduate like 40 years ago, you know, how do we get past the homogeneity of that textual record, and get at some sense of the particularity? And I just think that for the Ming period, if thinking about the aristocracy is one of the kind of tools of for doing that, then that work is playing a valuable role. I mean, it's one way of doing it. It's by no means the only way of doing it, but it is one way of doing something which I think is important and valuable.
And that's perhaps a great place for us to come to a conclusion. So, Craig, thank you so much for your thoughtfulness, for your time. Now, there's a bunch of material that we didn't get a chance to even begin to speak about. The book is extraordinarily rich, and we've really just started to enter into a landscape of the book that's quite rich and quite varied, and it contains discussions well beyond what we had a chance to talk about in an hour. Given that, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Well, I would want to stress that, the visual is very important to me. I'm always saying to my students, make the argument visually. And I hope that the pictures in the book are not just there as illustrations of the argument. In some senses, there are places where for me, the illustrations are the argument. And I'm childishly pleased about the fact that this is, the very first book that I've ever published that has photographs in it that I took myself. I'm not a great photographer. They're not great photographs, but they're good enough. They're good enough. And I'm kind of just, childishly pleased with myself that I managed to not blow that part of it, that I came back from China with some images that I could actually use, because I'm just in awe of colleagues that I know who can take wonderful photographs just at the drop of a hat. So I'm sorry to boast about that, but that's what I'd like to boast about.
No, that's great. And I'm glad that you mentioned it, because that's something that's a really important part of the experience of the book as well. So I'm glad that we got that out there. Now, Craig, now that the book is out, and congratulations on what I hope is completely obvious, a book that I hope is obvious that I think is absolutely fabulous, and I think is also very important for a wide community of kinds of readers. So now that the book is out, what are you working on now? Are there any projects that you're currently working on that you're feeling particularly inspired by?
Well, there's one project which, of course, in a sense grows directly out of this, and that's a big exhibition that will open at the British Museum on the 18th of September this year, which is called Ming, 50 Years That Changed China, which is an exhibition about the first 50 years of the 15th century, the half century from 1400 to 1450. So things like the Liang Zhuangwang tomb falls, smack bang in the middle of this period. And this is really, this did grow out of this project. I kind of came back from China in 2009, having seen the material from this tomb, and I kind of got in touch with friends and colleagues at the British Museum. I said, this stuff is just fabulous. We've got to find some way of getting this in front of a British public. And I'd had very encouraging noises from colleagues in China about the potential feasibility of this. So after kind of many years of work, this exhibition is now kind of moving in its final stages. And that's what I'm, that's what's on the top of my to-do pile is, the catalogue of that. And that is, I think, important because, the exhibition, however successful it is, will, or unsuccessful, will still reach an audience which is very much bigger than the audience for a book like Screen of Kings, and it will reach people who are not specialists. And so, there's a tremendous responsibility to try and get that right. Of course, it's completely different from writing a book in that you don't have the kind of, you write a book, you can say what you like. You write, you work on an exhibition, you're immediately working with designers, with interpretive people, with the British Museum's very wonderful kind of publicity machine, so that you're it's a kind of public scholarship, which is quite different from the writing of a book. But I'm still finding that kind of fairly exciting. And then there's a project to work on. I'm finishing up a book called Chinese Painting and Its Audiences, which is based on a series of Mellon lectures that I gave at the National Gallery of Art in DC in 2012. And that's a much more kind of art, historical art. I mean, I'm arguing with a different set of people there. I'm arguing with art historians about kind of the role of the image in the early modern and modern worlds from kind of 1500 to now. And that book is just kind of coming to its end. And then I'd like to kind of take stock and think which is next. And, you know, every time I say I'm going to not work on the Ming next, I'm going to kind of retool and do something about the early 20th century, which is also a kind of great passion of mine. Then I find something else Ming interesting. So I'm making no promises, but those are the two projects that are kind of they're on the. I'm sitting at my desk looking at piles of material that I need to kind of do what process now in relation to those two projects.
Well, best of luck with that, Craig. Thank you so much again for making the time. It's really been a pleasure, and congratulations again on a fabulous book.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.